Good evening. My name is Meg Stemmler. I'm the producer of public programs at the New York Public Library, known as Live from the NYPL. Our mission, as described by director Paul Holdengraber, is to create cognitive theater and provide evenings of conversation that agitate the mind, bring ideas to life, and of course, make the lions roar. It is my pleasure to welcome you to our third event of 2010. Upcoming programs this spring season include author Richard Holmes on The Age of Wonder, artist William Kentridge, a tribute to George Carlin hosted by Whoopi Goldberg, and a conversation with George Prochnick on his book, In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise. I'm happy to announce that we just added a program scheduled for April 6th, featuring the New Yorker editor David Remnick and his new biography on Barack Obama titled The Bridge. Remnick will be in conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Other events to look forward to this season include Peter Carey, Lena Herzog, Christopher Hitchens, and an evening on the World Cup. Become a friend of the library for just $40 and receive discounted tickets on every live event. Please consider donating to Live from the NYPL. It is because of your support that we're able to produce these evenings. After the conversation, we invite you to ask questions. Please come up to the microphone that'll be in front of the stage and use the opportunity to ask questions instead of make statements. Paul Holdengraber has calculated that a question normally is about 53 seconds. Einstein may have agreed, I think. Both Krista Tippett and Andrew Salomon will be signing books tonight provided by your independent bookseller, 192 Books. We are thrilled to welcome Krista Tippett back to the stage this evening, who was last here in 2008 to discuss her book, Speaking of Faith, Why Religion Matters and How to Talk About It. Together with Stuart Brown, she looked at the relationship of faith and the science of play, unpacking the spiritual quest for a meaningful life. Krista Tippett is a Peabody Award-winning broadcaster and author. As the creator and host of Speaking of Faith at American Public Media, she's innovated a new model of intelligent, in-depth journalism about religion and spiritual ethics in every aspect of human endeavor. Her most recent book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, brings her to Live from the NYPL this evening for a conversation with Andrew Salomon, instigated by Paul Holdengraber. Krista found out today that her book is now at number 30 on the New York Times bestseller list. The book includes Tippett's conversations with scientists, both religious and non-religious, including Freeman Dyson, Jana Levin, Mehmet Oz, Sherwin Nuland, and others, as an examination of the science of faith. Science and faith. Andrew Salomon has argued that science and humanism are two different vocabularies for a single set of phenomena, and that understanding order through the laws of mathematics and understanding order through faith in life's underlying purpose are really an identical exercise. Andrew Salomon is a lecturer in psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and currently a scholar at Yaddo. His book, The Noonday Demon and Atlas of Depression, won him 14 national awards, including the 2001 National Book Award. He's currently completing a PhD in psychology at Cambridge and writing Love Matters, Discovering the Horizontal Family. The book is about the experience of families with children who are unusual or extraordinary, including raising children with autism, Down syndrome, deafness, and dwarfism. Salomon also looks at families of people who commit crimes and families of prodigies. He describes his book as a study of the resilience of parental love. Krista Tippett's Einstein's God illuminates the wonder and awe possessed by Albert Einstein in his personal philosophy and his approach to science. Einstein could not conceive of a God who rewards or punishes his creatures, but he did leave behind a fascinating legacy of musings and writings, some serious, some whimsical, about the relationship between science and religion and his own inquisitive reverence for the order deeply hidden behind everything.
It followed from the special theory of relativity that mass and energy are both different manifestations of the same thing, a somewhat unfamiliar conception for the average mind. Furthermore, the equation E is equal mc squared, in which energy is put equal to mass multiplied with the square of the velocity of light, showed that very small amount of mass may be converted into a very large amount of energy, and vice versa. The mass and energy were, in fact, equivalent. According to the formula mentioned above, This was demonstrated by Cockcroft and Walton in 1932 experimentally.
I believe that Gandhi's views were the most enlightened of all the political men in our time. We should strive to do things in his spirit, not to use violence in fighting for our cause, but by non-participation in anything you believe is evil.
It's a real pleasure to welcome you both here tonight, Krista Tippett and Andrew Solomon. Andrew, had you ever heard Einstein speak before?
I had never heard those bits of Einstein speaking, no. And it was compelling and extraordinary to have his voice pouring out into the space, almost as though he had come from above.
I was discouraged by Krista Tippett's producer to play it because of his accent. She said that compared to Einstein, I sounded as though I came from South Dakota. And I decided we must play it because it would make me look very good.
Paul, you always look very good.
Well, thank you, thank you. Krista, it's a great pleasure to have you back. I think you were here two and a half years ago to speak with Stuart Brown on the relationship between faith, religion, and play. And now you've written this book, which we hear is 30th on the bestseller list, the New York Times bestseller list, Einstein's God. Let me start by asking you a very obvious question. Why this book now? Why this title?
Well, the title is the title of the program we did on Einstein, in which both of those clips appeared. I think Kate did not prevail. I think we got them into the program as well. Wasn't that a wonderful way to start?
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah. And I was thinking about how Paul Davies, who's one of the people I interviewed for that show,
who we will be hearing in a little while,
is an astrobiologist and a physicist, and he talked about how Einstein's view of time, you know, Einstein always said that our sense of time as compartmentalized, as an arrow moving forward through past, present, and future is a stubbornly persistent illusion. Our five senses conspire in that illusion. And Paul Davies explained to me how in Einstein's conception of block time, you know, really in some way that I can't begin to grasp, so I can just say what he's explained to me, you know, it is really all happening at the same time.
Does this happen to you often that you're speaking with these scientists and you can't completely grasp what they're talking about?
Yes, I do not understand E equals MC squared. But he said that you may have your four score years and 10, but the entirety of your life is still imprinted. It's still there. And I did have this feeling when we did the show with Einstein, and it came back to me when we were listening to his voice.
On Einstein.
Yeah, with Einstein. I did commune with Einstein at a cosmic level. You know, that he's present. And although that sounds like a really lofty, strange concept, I think many of us have that experience with people in our own lives who have died, of the fact that they are imprinted beyond their lives. So why now? And these are some of the programs we do. I mean, this program was absolutely exhilarating, even though I still do not understand E equals MC squared. It was exhilarating for us as producers, and these conversations with scientists are some of the shows our listeners love the most, and that's always been true. And so when we talked about putting a book together finally that was centered around programs, it was very clear to me that we needed to pull out our scientists and our physicians.
And you attribute the love of the listeners for listening to scientists to what?
Well, that's a big question. Well, they're fascinating. And I think even in publishing, you can look at writing about religion and writing about science as two of the only areas that are growing. There is this parallel curiosity about these things. And when you're able to bring them together...
Parallel,
yes. Yes.
Meaning they do not intersect.
Not necessarily. And in fact, in our public life, as we all know, and I think even on this stage, didn't you have Christopher Hitchens and Al Sharpton?
Your favorite men.
My favorite. Yeah. Well, in our public life, we've pit them against each other, and they've been debated and set at odds. But nevertheless, there is this parallel curiosity. I think this parallel sense that both of these things together tell us about what it means to be human, which is a very large canvas. And when you can, as we do, when we bring scientists onto Speaking of Faith, when you can bring those things into conversation, when you can even just hear the echoes between the questions they're raising, not setting their answers one against the other, it's wonderful.
Forgive me for reading something for a minute, but I much enjoy this passage from Clive James in his book called Cultural Amnesia. It's an entry on Charlie Chaplin. They cheer me because they all understand me, and they cheer you because no one understands you. That's Charlie Chaplin to Albert Einstein at the 1931 premiere of City Lights.
Right.
On the big night, both of the great men looked good both in their tuxedos, but the film star was undoubtedly the more adroit and social charm. He said exactly the right thing. He wasn't quite right, however, about the no one understands you. By now, almost everyone literate, every literate person can recite the equation E equals MC square and even give a rough account of it. To give a rough account is, however, not the same as giving a precise one, and having some idea is not the same as understanding. Chaplin's remark nailed down a discrepancy between two kinds of knowledge, the artistic and the scientific. The power of science is to transform the world in ways that not even scientists can predict. Mm-hmm. The power of the humanities is to interpret the world in ways that anyone can appreciate. Einstein knew that science had given Chaplin the means to be famous. Einstein also knew that Chaplin could live without a knowledge of science. But as Einstein told Chaplin on many occasions, he himself, Einstein, could not love without the knowledge of the humanities. Einstein loved music, for example, and was so wedded to the concept of aesthetic satisfaction that he gained added face in his general relativity equations from finding them beautiful and frowned on the propositions of quantum mechanics because he found them shapeless. On the latter point, he turned out to be wrong, and physicists in the next generation were generally agreed that the aesthetic sense had led him astray. Whoever was inspired to invent the tuxedo, however, did the world a service. On that big night, the two different geniuses looked like the equals they were. Mm. What was my point? Except for the aesthetical pleasure of it all. I think my point, to some extent, and I think the point maybe of Clive James in Cultural Amnesia, of linking Charlie Chaplin to Einstein, is to talk about something that comes out so fabulously in one of your interviews with Freeman Dyson, is Einstein's extraordinary sense of humor.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
And what I wrote when I was reflecting on that show is, I did have this feeling of almost giddiness coming out of it. And going into it, it was quite daunting to think we're going to talk about Einstein's ideas. But there was a logic of sorts to that giddiness, because he was a funny guy, and he used humor. And Freeman Dyson said that his sense of humor went hand in hand with the fact that being a great scientist means failing a lot of the time. It means failing many times on the way to every great discovery. And Einstein's...
And you need humor.
Well, his sense of humor was what allowed him to pick himself up and keep going and even be graceful about it.
I see a big smile developing there.
Well,
And maybe the notion of resilience comes in play here,
there's
too.
There's always a smile when I hear Krista's eloquent words. But I was just thinking that the passage you read is very interesting, and it's interesting to me because I've ended up on this platform, despite the fact that I spent most of my childhood with no interest in either faith or science, but a great interest in the arts and the humanities. And I think what Krista really looks at in her book is not simply the intersection of faith and, it's not simply the intersection of humanity and science, but it's also faith, which is also about the imponderable and the incomprehensible. And really, I think the virtue of this very splendid book is that it brings together two different ways of identifying the vastness and incomprehensibility of experience outside the sort of narrow confines of the individual human being, and that what Charlie Chaplin was getting at was being able to move entirely inside, and that that's then the translational act of people who write books or conduct interviews on stage at the library or have radio shows. So I think there are three pieces to this rather than two that are constellated.
I would like us to listen to the first clip we have.
He had a marvelous sense of humor, and that's a very important part of life. And of course, the fact is that scientists have, on the whole, cultivated a sense of humor, because so much of science is a history of failures. I mean, most, if you're a creative person, it's true in other kinds of creative life, but more in science, that so much of science ends up to be wrong, and that you do something, you spend weeks and months, and finally the whole thing collapses. Well, you need to have a sense of humor, otherwise you couldn't survive. And Einstein, I think, understood that particularly well.
I wanted to ask you what physicists are learning now that would befuddle him, what would intrigue him, and I suppose we've already wandered into that territory. What else is happening now that perhaps he made possible but that might surprise him?
Well, I think the big thing that he made possible but which he never accepted was black holes, places where big stars have collapsed and effectively disappeared from the universe, except that there's left behind a hole where the star used to be. So you have there a very strong gravitational field without any bottom. The black hole is the only place where space and time are really so mixed up that they behave in a totally different way. I mean, that you fall into a black hole and your space is converted into time and your time is converted into space.
Sort of the ultimate relativity.
Yes. Uh-huh. In a way, it's the most exciting and the most beautiful consequence of his theory. I mean, nature would not be the same without them. And I think if Einstein came back, he really would be surprised by that. I mean, he would have to accept, if he came back now, he would have to accept that black holes are real and they're here to stay. And they are actually a tremendous triumph for his own ideas. So I think it would be amusing to see his reaction. I'm sure he would accept it. Probably he'd make some very suitable joke.
Any reaction to that?
I mean, I think it's exquisitely and beautifully said. I think the issue of Einstein's, the relationship for him between an aesthetic appreciation, the beauty that he found in the laws that he saw, and the actual concrete applications and consequences of them, that's a significant leap. And I think it's often the case that you have a visionary who has the idea in its purest and most abstract form, and that the distance from that abstraction to a concrete reality is sometimes a difficult one. I don't profess to be an expert on the extent to which Einstein could work out those correlations. He knew a lot of things I don't. But I think that the essence really of what Dyson is saying is that you have to have a grand vision, and then you have to have people to refine it and to make sense of it and to adduce it into something which is actually relevant and useful to the fabric of our lives, or indeed of the life of the universe.
And what is...
Please. Well, you know, I just want to say that...
How is it listening
for me,
to this? It must be interesting.
Oh, it's fun. It's fun. See, I learned enough to be able to say that's the ultimate relativity. Like, I barely knew what I was saying. I was quite impressed to hear that.
Do you feel you knew what you were saying?
I sounded like I knew what I was saying.
It's
this
not
is
easy,
the fiction we create. For me, what's spiritually intriguing about Einstein is along the lines Andrew said, this curiosity about what is imponderable and mysterious and cosmic. But it's interesting to note that a lot of the times when Einstein talked about God, in fact, he was joking. So when he said, God does not play dice with the universe, that was not
a
statement
of faith.
Which comes
in the book
that
five or six times.
He was actually weighing in against quantum physics, which, as you said, he found completely disorderly and unacceptable, aesthetically unacceptable as well as scientifically.
Would give you an aesthetic headache.
But what's also funny is that he said, God does not play dice with the universe, and Niels Bohr, who was his adversary in that debate, shot back, who is Einstein to tell God what to do? So I don't think that we have any kind of cultural memory or that we pick that up, even that scientists make those kinds of jokes.
It's interesting to see how many of the scientists in your book quite freely and quite quickly talk about the beauty of the universe and the elegance of the universe.
Yes.
I'd like to play the second and last clip we'll be hearing.
Einstein was fond of using the word God, and there are many famous quotations. God does not play dice
That's
with the
right.
universe.
This
is his antipathy to quantum physics and its indeterminism. Sometimes he was really using God as just a sort of façon de parler, a convenient metaphor. But he did have, I think, a genuine theological position. He did not believe in a personal God. He made that very clear. But he did believe in a rational world order, and he expressed what he sometimes called a cosmic religious feeling, a sense of awe, a sense of admiration at the intellectual ingenuity of the universe, not just its majesty, its grandness, its vast size, but its extraordinary subtlety and beauty and mathematical elegance, something that people who are not physicists find it very hard to grasp. But to a professional physicist, this notion of an underlying mathematical beauty is part and parcel of the subject.
And you also raise the kind of religious, theological questions that for you still flow out of these great discoveries of Einstein and of physics as we know them now. Burning questions that remain, maybe we don't need God for the laws of physics to do their job, but where do the laws of physics come from? Why these laws rather than others? And here's some language of yours. Why a set of laws that drive the searing, featureless gases coughed out of the Big Bang toward life and consciousness and intelligence and cultural activities such as religion, art, mathematics, and science? I mean, are those questions that you can ask now, this way down the road? Did Einstein consider questions like that?
For me, the crucial thing is that the universe is not only beautiful and harmonious and ingeniously put together, it is also fit for life. And physicists have traditionally ignored life. It's too hard to think about. More and more, though, I think we have to recognize that if the laws of physics hadn't been pretty close to what they are, there would be no life. There would be no observers. Now, some scientists just shrug and say, well, so what? You know, if it had been different, we wouldn't be here to worry about it. But I think that's unsatisfactory, and the reason I think it's unsatisfactory is because the universe has not only given rise to life, it's not only given rise to mind, it's given rise to thinking beings who can comprehend the universe. Through science and mathematics, we can, so to speak, glimpse the mind of God, as we've been discussing.
In the first line of your book, in the introduction, you say that the science-religion debate is unwinnable and it has led us astray. Do you find that... First of all, what is that debate? You mentioned Hitchens, we could mention Dawkins, we could mention a number of other people. But do you find that debate boring?
I find that debate beside the point of what's really interesting and important that we all might like to and be enriched by reflecting on, taking in. I mean, you know, we were talking about how, on the one hand, there are scientific notions, the kinds of ideas Einstein had that most of us can't grasp. But on the other hand, we all deal with science. We have an experience of science all the time, right? Every morning when we wake up and turn on our computers, every time we go to the doctor's office for anything remotely serious, every time we eat a meal, we are having an experience of science. So, and that's another reason that I think we are curious about it and that it's okay, actually, to really delve into it and really also explore it on this more sophisticated level at which Einstein was engaged. And so it's just, to me, it's common sense that we should pursue this. And most of us, and this is true, most of us also have some kind of...
And this is what? Pursue what? When you say pursue this?
What science is and what it is, what, how it tells us about what it means to be human and the universe we inhabit and our place in that.
This debate between religion and science.
Yeah, and I mean, and when we do that, I mean, when I pursue that, asking the questions I ask, well, yes, the debate becomes an industry. But it's been interesting to me how quickly that has evolved, right? I mean, we did have this surge of strident religious voices in our public life, which was traumatic. And then we had the backlash of the new atheists, which was in part a response to that. But, you know, very quickly, I feel like we've come to this different place, this thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And we're in a synthesis moment, and it's very exciting. And, you know, this book is part of that, but there's a lot going on that's speaking to the fact that it doesn't have to be a debate.
I was just going to say, in relation to the to Freeman Dyson's comments in the interview, that the one piece of it that he kind of sidesteps a little bit is what it means for these scientific and mathematical laws to be elegant laws, because elegance itself is a human perception. And I think for you to look at the universe and say what is extraordinary is that it is so ordered, and that we can appreciate that it's so ordered, is in itself, in some senses, a spiritual announcement or a humanist announcement, because the belief that one set of laws seems elegant and that some other set of laws or some quality of chaos seems inelegant is a deeply and profoundly human belief. And the complexity of the relationship between that intimate human notion of elegance and that vast truth that governs the operations of the universe. That, I think, is an area of tension, and it is an area in which just what Krista was talking about becomes true. Science has a great deal to say about it. Religion has a great deal to say about it. By pulling together those two bodies of knowledge, one is much more likely to arrive at insight than one is by holding them each in its own place. Mm.
Paul Davis, the second interview is by Paul Davis.
Sorry.
And there's so many others I should have introduced who it was. Paul Davis.
They both have British accents.
Pardon?
Yes.
They both have a British accent. Who am I to talk about accents anyway? And in an interview, a splendid one I would have loved to play, with Sherwin Newland, you discuss a human spirit. A simple question would be for each one of you, perhaps Andrew, you could start, to define what you understand by this notion of spirit.
It's a very...
something we talked about a couple of years.
You did talk about it.
We did talk about it, indeed.
But 3 years have gone by, yes. And you've evolved. Yes. So how do you see it today?
I think it's an enormously, enormously interesting and complex and challenging question, and it's really what brought me, I think, to talking to Krista, to this platform, to looking at questions of faith and of existence. I talked about it on the program in connection with having had a very severe depression, and with my sense as I came out of the depression that while it was a grotesque and horrible experience in many ways, it also afforded me a great deal of insight, and that there was something curious and fascinating to me about the fact that when, at some level, everything had seemed so bleak, there was a piece of me that fought on, and I didn't know what to call it. And in writing the book and in the final paragraphs of that book, I talked about it as a spirit.
You use the word soul. Or
soul, yes, yeah. Exactly. And since that time, I have sort of bookended, in a way, that experience of the soul as a revelation out of despair with the experience of becoming a father and having a sense that there also is something so mystical and so extraordinary in that joyful experience that it goes beyond the ability of concrete scientific or even humanist language to describe. And so I think when one speaks of a spirit, one speaks of a human soul, one speaks of a sort of greater spirit, it's, I think, a deference to the ultimate inexplicability of things. No matter how exquisite and varied the laws are, no matter how deeply one studies the inside of oneself or the workings of the world outside, the sense of there being a profound unknowability. And I think if one is prepared to acknowledge that unknowability, and indeed even to celebrate that unknowability, that seems to me to be the essence of this kind of scientific humanist faith that Krista expresses so well in the book and that we're talking about here.
Krista.
Well, let me just follow on that to say that where there are divisions, and there are, and there, I mean, I think each of us in our own lives, out of our own experiences, put different words and concepts around this part of life. And it's hard to put words around it because it ultimately defies words. Where there is a division, though, especially with scientists, I think what you just described, many people are quite comfortable not needing to call the soul or not needing to say, well, does this mean we were created or there is a God? It's not their question. It's not a burning question. Religious people, of course, do capture that not just in words, but in ritual, in communities, in prayer. That doesn't mean we're not having a kindred experience. And
but
I think Andrew, that's what we're
Andrew
trying
felt
to describe.
The need to use the word soul.
But he used it sparingly, I remember.
Twice.
Because I had Andrew on my show. You know, Andrew's not a religious thinker, as you said. But I heard Andrew. I had had an experience of depression myself, so I was interested in this subject. But I kept hearing Andrew interviewed, and I read that incredible piece you wrote in The New Yorker, right? And I kept hearing how the interviewers pushed and pushed about your physical breakdown, about what was happening biologically. And yet, between the lines, I could tell that you were also talking about what was at the core of you, as you say, that kept fighting, and also what you experienced as afterwards, as you moved through that, because I think a lot of these kinds of observations can't be made until afterwards, but what you experienced afterwards that you could only name now because you had feared its disappearance. You had sensed its absence.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that you say that. I've just been writing a long tribute to my college roommate who died recently. And in the course of writing it, I was struck by the fact that the attention that was embodied in this act of writing is a kind of attention that he longed for when he was alive and that I was perhaps less disposed to offer. And the lovely thing, in a way, about having gone through that depression and come out, at least for now, on the other side of it, is that I think that the sense of losing things gave me a great and tremendous feeling of their value, and that now that I am not depressed and am beyond those darkest moments, the things that I thought I had lost, as they have gradually come back to me, have come back far richer and far more beautiful than they would have. Now, it's very easy to go from that to this kind of banal glorification of suffering,
right,
and, you know, people endlessly saying the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me was being hit by a bus, and
right,
if I hadn't lost my leg, I would never have turned into myself, and so on. I think that there are a lot of dangers in that direction. And I think in the work I'm doing now, which deals with disability, one sees frequently people who are sort of arguing so strenuously for the virtue of their dark experiences. But I do think that actually, and again, this goes back to this question of what is a human spirit. Part of what a human spirit is, I think, is something that quests after meaning in darkness, because life and the world are full of enormous amounts of darkness for everyone in one way or another at one time or another. And as I began to think about those things, and I thought, well, what are these things that I value, and why am I trying to spin from this gruesome time, not simply to forget it, but to try to build something out of it, I kept thinking, where do these impulses come from? And I've always been terribly uncomfortable with dogma and with organized religion. I find some ritual very beautiful, but I find many of the sort of concrete tenets difficult to deal with. And yet at the same time, I felt that within humanism, within art, within literature, there wasn't a language to talk about, even within psychology, which is the area in which I have some experience, or psychiatry, which I teach, that there wasn't the vocabulary really to look at these mm-hmm. things, and that an attempt to speak of them in those terms was necessarily to reduce them, and that was to lose a great deal.
And you know, in terms of where science comes into this, or medicine, which is science, I think the thing that you talked about that really helped people and people in the depths of depression themselves or who'd lived with it in loved ones was you talked about how medication had helped you get better, and that fact did not it did not diminish, it did not change who you were, that there was, that you were aware of an identity, a core identity, that in fact was renewed by the medication, not taken away. Right, there was that line of Jane Kenyon, I take one pill and another, and then I fall into myself again.
Yes.
And it's giving people permission to treat this pharmacology seriously and not feel like it's a cop-out or that, in fact, you're not getting better, you're just leaning on pills, which I'm afraid is a place we go to.
And partly because you have an idea of identity, which is different. That's the real reason, is that the pills and medication doesn't take you away from yourself but gives you back to yourself.
I think it's really, again, about the thing that Krista has been emphasizing, which is the bringing together of vocabularies. Because on the one hand, my brain has been changed by the medication that I've taken now over many years, which has been very effective and to which I'm enormously grateful. On the other hand, my brain has also been changed by experiences of love and experiences of loss. And someday, when our brain scanning has advanced a great deal further than it has now, we may be able to look at a brain and say, oh, look, these are the physiological structures associated with profound faith. We may be able to say these, in fact, are the ones that are associated with a particular faith or a particular attitude toward faith or any of these other things. The fact that something exists physiologically doesn't mean that it doesn't also exist spiritually. That isn't a divide. And the fact that one has a spiritual experience does not mean that one isn't actually also having a physiological one. I mean, my brain is different than it would be if I'd never gone to college. That changed it too. Mm-hmm. And so it's the binaries. I think what Krista and I perhaps most have in common, and it's part of what I'm working on now and part of what's in this book, is a sort of aversion to those binaries as being, though they seem highly dramatic, as actually it's not that you get two wonderful separate things, it's that you get two deadened separate things instead of a sort of larger unity. Well, the synthesis.
The binary seems seductive also and yes. Easy.
That's also how we tend to talk about everything in this culture.
In the last page of the noontide, the demon at noontide, the noonday,
noonday demon.
I get it wrong. There's another book called The Demon at Noontide, also about melancholia, so I get it wrong. You write, curiously enough, I love my depression. I do not love experiencing my depression, but I love the depression itself. I love who I am in the wake of it. The opposite of depression, and this is a line that you love so much, is not happiness, but vitality. And my life, as I write this, is vital even when sad. And I'm also struck by the very beginning of the book, where you have this extraordinary line, in my view, where you say, depression is a flaw in love. It's haunting.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, what I meant by that, really, is that you can't experience love as we know it unless you have an awareness of the possibility of loss, that our valuation of really everything has to do with its potential transience. And if your experience of love were that you were rapturously happy to be with someone, and then if they dropped dead Wednesday, you thought, oh, well, there we are, and you went on to the next, it would not be love as we know and understand it. And so I think depression, which is a kind of extreme version of those feelings of sadness and loss and despair and all of that desolation, is on the one hand, you know, perfectly dreadful, and on the other hand, without it, we wouldn't have love as we know it. And so it's a price that we pay. And I think the purpose of the book was to say that while my depression got well and truly out of control, and it would have been just fine if it had been somewhat more constrained, that I wouldn't want to give up the sort of negative end of a large mood spectrum, because I think without the negative end, it's not simply that you need it for contrast. It's also that the awareness always of the proximity of loss increases your pleasure in and your strong connection to what you have.
Krista, you suffered, you mentioned it very quickly, you suffered from depression about 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. You experienced it literally in the Latin word, a sense of the word experire, that you went through the peril of the depression. Describe as much as you can that experience, also the way in which that experience made you lose I think in your case it would be accurate to say your sense of God and how it might have brought it back to you after that depression came to an end at that point.
You know, maybe not so much now, but even in the last few decades, there was still some question mark beside whether mind, body, and spirit are the same thing or how they're connected. Well, depression is the ultimate mind, body, spirit enmeshment, right? It's in a negative sense. But the symptoms are physical. They're not, it's sad is not a big enough word. As Andrew said, it's the absence of vitality. It's not really sadness. So I had a classic clinical depression. It was different from Andrew's, and but it was, I couldn't sleep. I lost weight. I was overwhelmed by a feeling of hopelessness and failure and guilt, and it just, you could check all the boxes beside symptoms of depression.
And you came from grandfather who was a Baptist minister.
Yeah, I came from a culture where people didn't talk about this, and I don't think they talked about it in much of American culture until
here
recently.
Here I am asking you. We didn't talk about it.
Yeah, well, it's hard. I don't. I haven't talked about
people.
It as much as Anne.
No, but
the thing is, I wouldn't say I lost my faith. It's more profound than that. When you are in the midst of a depression, I mean, I couldn't imagine believing in God or disbelieving in God. You do feel completely cut off. I couldn't imagine ever feeling hopeful again. So even to say that I have no faith would have been too much of a declarative statement for what I was capable of making. Now, I did have enough presence of mind to know that I hadn't always felt that way, and hopefully I wouldn't feel that way forever. But when we put this program on depression on the air, and we continue to put it on the air about once a year, once every 18 months, because it really helps people. But I had to put a little disclaimer at the front in the script, just saying, you know, if you are right in the middle of this, this is not the show for you. Right. Because when you are in that dark place, don't expect yourself to be able to reflect on it or find meaning. It can take 20 years before people can talk that way about it.
And you hope that the people who are in a deep depression will understand that disclaimer.
Yes, although, I do, yeah, exactly. I have to say, we've heard from people who've said that they were in the middle of a depression and they played it over and over and over again. And I know what that's about. And that's not about taking in a lot of these beautiful words. That's about having evidence that other people have been in this place and come out the other side. Because that is something you long for middle of it.
Okay.
And I think that depression really is, it's a disease of loneliness, and that you may be very lonely while surrounded by love, but you lose the sense of connection and attachment. And I think anything that mitigates that loneliness, and I'm not chilling for my radio performance here, but anything that mitigates that loneliness in any way is very helpful. And frequently part of the loneliness is that people are depressed, they're surrounded by people who love them and keep saying, but you shouldn't be depressed, but you should
feel
better.
Worse.
I should, yes. Exactly, and that just makes you feel worse. And so I think it's this knowledge of what depression actually is, in the sense that other people know it too, and that you aren't alone in that experience.
You talk about that quite movingly in that same chapter where Andrew finds himself with Parker Palmer, who talks about a friend who just described
that
moment.
Yes, the two things in that show that help people so much are Andrew's description of being, of knowing who he was and that being something he could retain and that was real. And then Parker Palmer, who was a great head of a spiritual community in his 40s when he had his depression. And so for him, people were saying, but you're so wise, you're so spiritual, you're so successful, and that made him feel worse and worse and worse. And he had a friend who came every day when he was in this depression where he was pretty much catatonic, I mean, could really not speaking, not leaving the house. And somehow this person intuited that the one place in his body that could still have sensation and respond to touch was his feet. I don't know how this person intuited this. And this person would come and rub Parker's feet every day for 2 weeks. Not talk, not ask him to talk, not ask him how he was doing, not tell him it would be all right, but
just
awaken
touch.
Sensation in him, and I suppose a physical connection with someone else. Mm. And that, as much as anything else, pulled him through. And so many people talk about that image being useful for them.
But would it be fair to say, to find some difference between the two of you, would it be fair to say that you came out of your depression and holding on to something quite different than what you came out of your depression holding on to? You did come out of your depression in some way finding meaning again in religion, in spirituality, in God, and perhaps not having quite the same problems Andrew has with dogma.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I also learned a lot about myself. To the extent that I would say I'm glad for my depression, it's because I did go into therapy and there were things I needed to know about myself. And I would actually use some similar words, that there was sadness and there was darkness and there was pain that I hadn't incorporated into my sense of myself or the way I told the story of my life. And I am more complete because I can do that. Now, I also see that as a spiritual exercise, looking back on it. But the one thing that I leaned on that was religious, that was remotely religious in my depression, was the Psalms, and especially the Psalms that I'd never liked very much. I know there are all these Psalms in the Hebrew Bible about enemies. You know, and even that beautiful song, "By the Waters of Babylon, We Lay Down." We don't sing the rest of the words to that song, where they start throwing their enemies' babies against a wall. It's incredibly violent.
One can't quite imagine the music to that.
No, we can't. I always hated those Psalms. And when I was in services where people recite the Psalms, I wouldn't say them. But somehow around my depression, I learned that a lot of the church fathers, the great minds of Christianity, had also interpreted that those enemies in the Psalms could be enemies within. And I did feel like that. I felt that I was under siege by parts of myself. And somehow praying those Psalms, which don't resolve anything, they just let you say it. I hate this, I hate this, I hate these enemies, get them out of my life. So I found this piece of religion that I'd never found meaningful before to be completely transformed.
I'd like to read a passage from an interview you did with Paul Davies. We heard him before. "We can truly feel part of nature in a cosmic sense, not just in a local sense, but in a genuinely cosmic sense. I think that's deeply inspiring, whatever one's religious convictions. And even if you have no religious convictions, I often say that if I talk to someone like Steven Weinberg, who's a professed atheist and quite militantly so, to which you say, he's one who said, the more we learn, the more pointless it seems." Right. I think the exact line is slightly different.
Correcting me?
I am. "The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it seems pointless."
Thank you for that, Paul.
Pardon?
Thank you.
It's
for
the second edition.
my editor's here.
And then David says, that's right. "And yet, nevertheless, he will share in the awe, the wonder, the majesty, the beauty of the universe in the cosmic connection that I've been talking about. He sees the same facts as I do, but he can't bring himself to believe that there's any point behind it all. And that's where he and I will part company. We'd agree on all of the science, but to me, it overwhelmingly suggests that the universe is about something, that there is a point to it, and that's where we part of whatever point that is." Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to develop, because it comes again and again in these interviews, the notion of wonder, the mm-hmm. notion of awe. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and Einstein often talked about wonder as something that scientists share with artists. I think he said that wonder is behind all true art and true science. It's not a word that I think those of us who whose lives are mostly outside the realm of science associate with scientists, just like we don't realize how much beauty matters to them, as you said.
Yeah.
I've had a physicist say to me, you know, if an equation is not beautiful and elegant, it is likely not true. Well, I think that's the way we would think that a poet would speak or a painter would speak. But it's commonplace. It really is. It's in all the scientists. Now, I think some scientists get nervous when they hear people like me talking about scientists and wonder and that I'm romanticizing that or that I'm suggesting that they are, you know, putting connotations on that that are religious in the way a religious person might. And I don't. I don't assume that. Even Paul Davies is very much like Einstein in that he, you know, he comes right up to saying, there seems to be purpose to this, there seems to be a point to this. But he doesn't go on and say, I believe that there is a personal God. He's not a traditionally religious person. He also doesn't refute that. He just doesn't need to go there.
Do you sometimes feel that you're, when you're having these conversations with scientists, you're trying to find the religion in them?
No. I don't have any longing to harmonize these things. I am out there when I'm talking to religious audiences, as I have been in a couple of places in the last weeks. I'm saying to them, you know, whether scientists are religious or not, they are making discoveries. They are raising questions that are the raw material of theology. I think some of the most interesting and important theological questions may be raised by neuroscience in the 21st century. And that is true whether those scientists have any kind of personal faith or not. That's intriguing to me.
I saw Andrew shaking his head partly because you're studying all of this now. And I'd like you to both continue on this path, but also tell us a little bit about this work you're doing now on unorthodox identities, and
right,
maybe also talk a little bit about your most extraordinary family.
Right.
Sorry.
That's a number of things to keep track of all at once. I would begin by saying, just in response to what Krista has been talking about, that I perceived in reading the interviews with various scientists there that there is frequently discomfort on the part of science with a religion that professes to provide an enormous number of answers. And there is an enormous interest on the part of science in a religion that poses complex questions. And that to some extent, I think that divide between the dogmatic and the spiritual, if one wants to use, I mean, the vocabulary is also loaded now, but I think that that's what it's about. And I think that the idea of a spirit of inquiry is something which is shared quite broadly, and the sense of what the answers are to that inquiry, or indeed what the sequelae are to them, is more loaded. The work I've been doing has been really about the idea that the categories of illness and identity are very fluid categories, and that many things that were once thought of as illnesses are now thought of as identities. When I was born, it was actually in the state of New York both a crime and a mental illness to be gay. And now I'm married to my husband, who's here in the audience, and we have kids, and we have a whole life that was unimaginable when I was growing up. And having lived through that transformation and having experienced both the darkness of what was and the joy of what is as part of my own experience, I became very interested in this idea that something can move from one category to another. And so I started looking at deaf activists and whether deafness is an illness or is an identity. And I started looking at transgender activists and their attempt to get transgenderism taken out of the psychiatric manuals and all of these other categories, autism activists. And what I ultimately came up with is that everything, in some sense, can be described as an illness or as an identity, and everything can be analyzed either as a medical construct. There are medical constructs around all of these categories, or it can be encountered on the other hand as an identity in which people can feel a sense of righteousness and engagement and pride. And how we move in those categories and how much we acknowledge the fluidity of them, I think, is a measure of how advanced our society is. So that's the project that I'm working on now. Now, there's lots of it that's fascinating to me, but probably not relevant to this immediate conversation. But I've been thinking a great deal about a particular contrast that I've experienced in working on the chapter I've been doing about people who are transgender and about the battles that trans people face right now. And what I have encountered in that chapter is an extraordinary opposition in which there are a number of families whom I've talked to who, when they're it's mostly parents of children. When their children emerged as transgender, they were not allowed to come into church anymore. There was one family that was run out of town by the Ku Klux Klan, sort of all coming in and saying that they were doing it in the name of Jesus Christ. There was a great deal of hideous and grotesque oppression. I mean, this was actually a plot in which people attempted to murder an 8-year-old child on ground that this child was evil and were doing it in the name of Christ. At the same time, I have also experienced people who have had extraordinary acceptance within the context of religion. And there's one family that I'd followed, and in the end, the trans daughter who had born a boy but had been captain of the football team and had become a woman was invited back to give the sermon at church on a particular Sunday and spoke to the theme of the prodigal son and said, this is ordinarily a story, really, of that's told from the father's perspective, what it was like for him to welcome the prodigal son home. I will speak to it as the prodigal who has returned, and I will say that the miracle of love is a love which is abiding, which is true, that has me here in the same church that I grew up in, and which is able to accept even that which remains incomprehensible to it, even what happened in a far-off land that is never to be known and never to be understood. And so I've seen organized religion in these cases operating at either end of what is for me a spectrum of good and evil, but which could also be a spectrum of illness and identity or a spectrum of sort of science and humanism. There are a variety of ways that one can parse it.
I've never quite thought of it this way, but on this very stage, a couple of years ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing Jan Morris, who's one of the greatest writer. She hates the term travel writer right. of plays. She used to be called James Morris. She's the first woman who got the scoop from the Himalaya back to the Queen of England. And at the very end of the interview, she read a passage of Conundrum, which specifically talks about a virtue that I think must be close to your heart in that context, which is the importance and virtue of kindness. Mm. And I imagine now thinking and listening to you that her attentiveness to kindness comes from her own transformation and the need to be accepted.
Well, it was Hillel, I think, who said, was it Hillel? One of you will probably know, who said, was asked to recite the Bible while he stood on one foot and said, do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. The rest is commentary, now go and study. I think it can be reduced to kind. I think a great deal of what we're talking about actually can be reduced to wonder and kindness. I think those are perhaps the central
elements. And kindness always
seems
like such a weak virtue, doesn't it?
Tenderness is another great word that we can hardly use. Yeah, but it's so powerful, right? Kindness. Kindness is, it's one of these innocuous, sounds innocuous, right? But being kind in these in moments of our lives is one of the most effective, powerful things we can do, moving through our days, really, really affecting other people around us.
The English language is so good with the word kindness if you hear the word kin in it, which it comes from.
You know, I wanted to say, Andrew, I'm just learning about this new project, and it's fascinating. And what I love about it, too, is, one of the favorite shows we've done in the last few years was on autism. And actually, there's this physicist in the book, Jan Eleven, who had written a novel about two 20th century mathematicians, Alan Turing, who probably was autistic, somewhere on the spectrum. But what I love about what you're doing, and as you say, it's so important not to glorify difficult conditions, difficult identities, let's say. And yet, we do, in this culture tend to leap, and this is maybe where we're too into our science and our medicine, to leap to classify something as an illness and a problem, which means that the way we're looking at it is, well, how did it happen and how can we fix it? And how can we treat it? And those often are good and important questions, but there's the other question about what does this tell us about what it means to be human in all the fullness of that reality?
And the word optimism, what were you following there?
I don't like the word optimism.
Did you use it before?
Mm-mm.
No.
I like the word hope, but not the word optimism.
How about you?
I think I would vote for hope on a sort of popularity contest there. And I think I would vote for hope because I think optimism really suggests, I mean, I write in the Depression book about the fact that there is an adaptive advantage, an evolutionary advantage in seeing the world more positive, in a more positive light than reality would dictate, and that frequently people who are very depressed actually see things very clearly and very accurately. And I always quote the statistic that there was, in fact, at one point a study that was done in which they had depressed and non-depressed people play a video game for an hour, and at the end of the hour they asked them how many little monsters they thought they had killed, and the depressed people were mostly accurate to within 10%, and the non-depressed people guessed between 15 and 20 times as many little monsters as they had actually killed. That's optimism. Hope, it seems to me, is what we've been talking about here.
But
hope is reality-based.
No, but it also always reminds me of the notion of going to a doctor, and if you're sick and the doctor tells you you're well, there's really no hope. And so one actually needs an accurate measure. And your trajectory seems to... Well, it does meander.
Yes, it does, but absolutely.
It has, and digression, as I often say, is the sunshine of narrative. But beyond beyond the digression that you've been known to have in your own life, which has made you who you are, you're now going from having written this chronicle of despair, as you say in this piece you're working on now, to writing the chronicle of joy. And I'm particularly interested in your use of the word joy because there is another industry beyond the debate, science, religion debate, which is the happiness industry, right? With Project Happiness or whatever it is, Project Runway Happiness Project. And I was particularly struck by this fantastic quotation I had never read before by Charlotte Bronte. No mockery in this world ever sounds to me as hollow as that of being told to cultivate happiness, which I adore. So what are you, I mean, is it accurate? You're going from the chronicle of despair to a chronicle of joy.
It is accurate. I think that passage goes on to a whole extended metaphor about happiness not being
only
a potato.
Because I do not want
not
to keep people
what?
Here. Until
a potato.
A potato.
Yes.
Would you like me to read it? I'm happy to read.
No.
No, okay. Page 133 for those who are interested.
I mean, I think in the same way that we just drew a distinction between optimism and hope, that one can also draw something of a distinction between happiness in the sense in which you're using it. Not that I'm opposed to happiness, but happiness in the sense in which you're using it and joy. Because I think happiness is frequently what you're able to achieve when you cease to pay attention to what's happening. And joy is what you achieve when you engage at the deepest level with what's happening. That would be my distinction.
Reminds me of the line of Saul Bellow, who said that one doesn't love because, but in spite.
Yes. But I think in terms of my own work, I feel I subjected the world to a great many pages about misery, and I feel being
feel the time has
somewhat
come.
Less miserable. Yes, it's time to make recompense for it. But I do think that the things inform each other. I mean, it's back again to this breakdown of binaries. You know, the quality of the joy now would not be the same if it had not been for the depression. And, you know, the chances are this is a cyclical illness, medication or no medication. There's darkness ahead, and the quality of that darkness will be informed by any current experience of joy. So it's more about figuring out sort of how they play with each other than it is about sort of saying,
in the mode of happiness runway, kind of, I was miserable and now I'm happy and I'm not going to think about being miserable ever again because I'm through with that. It's integration, which again is really what Krista's book is focused on.
As we slowly wind down, the other great figure in this book besides Einstein is Darwin.
Yes.
And you have said that you feel that Darwin is misremembered.
Yes.
What might you mean in this
year? We know nothing about him. We have some phrases and some stereotypes. I mean, you know, we don't have another hour to talk about Darwin here, but we have imagined him as the scientist who began the rift between science and religion. But in fact, Darwin was not the first scientist to break with theology. He was the last scientist in a great long line of the classic scientists to take theology seriously. That's one thing. And another thing is that I love to learn about Darwin. You know, Darwin liberated religious people. I think he even liberated the creationists of our time from an idea of a God who did not merely create the universe all at once, once and for all, but who also preordained every injustice, every cell that goes cancerous, every shifting tectonic plate. That was an implication of that idea of creation. Darwin saw creation, and he did use that word, as an unfolding reality. That the world, that progression happened as all the parts of the creation defined their own fruitfulness through chaos and struggle and beauty and joy. So there are great gifts we have from Darwin that there are religious
that
gifts.
Haven't yet been received in some way.
Yes, and I love knowing him for the first time. You know, and Darwin in the beginning of his life was more religious and in the end was more agnostic. I mean, he was one of these people for whom in the end he didn't know the answer. He didn't need to say, well, did God set this in motion? That was a question mark. But
it reminds me, there's a passage which I remember we talked about when I did the radio program and which I've quoted in the book, but in The Winter's Tale, in which there's a debate taking place about the garden and whether the garden is an artifice or whether the garden is actually nature, and that very divide is being studied. And the line which kind of concludes the debate is that art itself is nature. The point being that even if you say this is something that has been done by human intervention, right, if humans have somehow come out of nature, there is a nature within it. And it's about bridging that exact thing. And I think that is very much really what I found in your reading of Darwin and in the conversation that you had, was that sense not of kind of throwing out the whole idea of there being splendor and mystery, but rather of saying, look at these extraordinary mechanisms and how extraordinary that we were created able eventually to decode and begin to comprehend them, and isn't that only a greater source of wonderment at where all of it came from?
Yeah, and I do have to say, there are scientists who themselves are religious, and those are amazing conversations as well, like John Polkinghorne, who's in the book,
Fantastic.
and others I've interviewed across the years. And I've heard so many scientists who are themselves people of faith use the word ingenious to describe evolution. What an ingenious way for God, who they believe in, to create the world. Mm.
What would your grandfather make of you being here?
Well, I don't know. I like to think he has evolved.
Well,
in that space before beyond time that Einstein made it possible for us to
perfect,
think of.
A perfect moment to use the idea of hope. I'd like to end with a quotation by Einstein that comes from a speech he gave in 1954. Human being is part of the whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. We experience ourselves, our thoughts and feelings as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from the prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Thank you very much. Now we will, there should be a microphone. And if you can come up to the microphone.
You know, Paul, that the optical delusion of consciousness is definitely a quote of Einstein. That quote is a little, there's something added to it. It's a little bit disputed. But
you're correcting me.
I'm
now.
Correcting you.
This is good. Why
not?
You know,
it's my turn. But the spirit is Einstein, and it's an Einstein we don't know.
Thank you for that. It will be my second interview with you, not my second edition, but you know.
Yeah.
So, how many questions are we limited to?
You're limited to one, and it should be brilliant.
Goodbye. This is not my question. Did you see last week's New Yorker, the article about psychiatry and pharmacology and the things you were talking about? Nobody's seen that? You write for the New Yorker, don't you?
I do, but I've been on retreat. I'm trying to write another book.
I mean, it's very pertinent to what you were talking about.
Right.
But, Mike, I guess this is particularly for Ms. Tippett. I'm going to make two statements, and I wonder how...
Remember the 53-second rule. Go
that's
ahead.
That's an average.
Go ahead.
What your experience is with people who are religious and scientists in answering commenting on these statements, and that is that, to me, it seems that religious people accept the fact that there's... basically a mystery and unknowability, you know, that their religion is not going to be able to answer. And I think it was Arthur Eddington who said something to the effect that not only is the universe strange, but it's stranger than we can even imagine. Mm-hmm. But in spite of that, it seems to me that the driving force for science is that...
I am going to ask you to ask a
that's
question.
It.
Is that they want just to answer the question.
Yeah,
I want
to know
the question.
What... Mm-hmm. The question is, do you, in your interviews, mm-hmm. do you find that this is an agreement among religious people and scientists, that a distinction is that scientists... believe that they can find out how it works, given that there is mystery still in
yeah,
the science.
You know, I often find people asking the question the other way and saying, well, isn't the distinction between scientists and religious people that religious people have certainties and scientists always think there's something else to discover? But I think you're right that, I once interviewed a geneticist who's also an Anglican priest. And he said he feels like the spirituality of a scientist is akin to the spirituality of a mystic, that both are bound in any given moment to discover whatever they can to discover, to discern truth as best they can, and yet are also thrilled knowing that there are things, that there's so much they have yet to discover. And I would say that describes a lot of the people I listen to on both sides of that divide.
Krista, hi, thank you for...
Put the mic down a bit. That's it.
Thank you for sharing your personal experience on depression with us. And you always seem to have so much equanimity when you speak, and your voice is always filled with joy. So it's surprising for me to hear about it. And I wondered if it's too personal to ask you how you got it, how long you had it, and how you got out of it.
I had a major, major depressive episode. This was in 1995, which was, it was a couple months building, and then I was really laid low. And then in the next 6 months, I came out and went back in again. But then I essentially came out of it. So I was very fortunate. The medication worked for me, and I did a lot of talk therapy. And the thing about having depression is that your life is ever after conditioned by the knowledge that you could go back to that place again. So it changes you. And in these in these 15 years, I have had a couple of other times when I've gotten either in that place or really peering over the edge. And it's something about who I am and my brain chemistry and how I've lived my life. So it's always a possibility for me.
I thank you to all of you. My name is Judith Engel, and I was inspired by the quote you just gave, Mr. Holden-Graeber, one from Andre Gide, and I would love to know why each of your guests' reactions is to it. I came across it yesterday. Andre Gide. Assuredly, because of nature, I think this is about right, man is born to happiness.
Wait, say it again. Assuredly?
Assuredly, because of nature, man is born to happiness. And I gave it some thought, and I'd love to know how you react to it.
You first.
It'll give you some time.
I mean, I think that really comes back to the sort of optimism, happiness, joy, all of those terms that we were trying to delineate earlier. I think it is actually true that there is a human inclination toward happiness at some level, because I think that that's part of what keeps us alive and reproducing, and that there are lots of DNA advantages in that. But I think it's quite fragile. I mean, I think the world is full of desolation and despair and cruelty, and I think Gide was deliberately being provocative, but being reductive. Yes, there is an inclination toward happiness when happiness is available, but there are so many conditions in which it becomes unavailable that it gets a slightly, I mean, it's quite a brilliant fortune cookie, but it does have a little bit of the fortune cookie in it, I think.
Yeah. It makes me think of a conversation I had earlier this year with Matthieu Ricard, who's a Tibetan Buddhist teacher, and he's thought a lot about happiness, and he's also been involved in the Dalai Lama's Mind Life Institute, which is bringing together scientists and Buddhist thinkers, and he talks about happiness. The definition of happiness that's really meaningful is the fullness of human flourishing. Mm-hmm. And human flourishing is not just about joy. It's not just about happiness, which I do find a difficult kind of facile word. Human flourishing does also mean being present to pain and suffering and failings and mistakes. And so there's a sense in which you can define happiness to bring all of that in, but I think that's the only way I could find that sentence to be compelling if I have that big definition of
we've just made
human
Gide
flourishing.
Much better.
I'm trying to improve on Gide. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I'm afraid of the hi. What role does politics play in science, scientific research, and also in spiritual endeavors?
That's a downer. You know, the question, what role does politics play? What role should politics play? It's not that that's not an important question. It's not a very interesting question to me. It's not really the focus of my curiosity and exploration. I don't know if you have...
Well, I think there's a sort of general perception that the effect of politics on everything that isn't politics is usually not a particularly positive one. And that being said, I think it's always been completely fascinating to me. I'm a dual national at the U.S. and the U.K., and in the U.K., there is a state religion, and religion and politics have virtually nothing to do with each other. And in the United States, where we have separation of church and state, there is a vast overlap between government and religion. And I spent a long time pondering that conundrum. And what I felt in the end was that the very separation gave people a sense of ownership over religion that people in Britain mostly don't have. And that in a curious way, the more you pull apart church and state, or indeed science and state, the more that you pull them apart, the more ironically they become enmeshed in each other.
Hi, I actually also, I wanted to thank you for your program, which kind of takes the dogma out of religion and really presents so many different theological thoughts in a way that are so thought-provoking. I really look forward to your
thank
program
you.
Every week. I wanted to ask you, though, and I'm not able to cite you precisely, even though I've sat here and listened intently, but you said that some of the most important progress, I think, on religion is being done by neuroscientists, and I apologize for not quoting you precisely, but I'd be interested to know exactly what your
okay, what I mean by that is I think neuroscience is raising all sorts of interesting questions that can be the raw material for theology, not just questions about what is the human mind, what is consciousness, what is the difference between them. It's raising questions about how we learn, about how we develop our personalities, about how we develop our capacity for joy, for relationship, perhaps for spirituality. And another thing that I'm fascinated by, and this is not just about neuroscience, where I think a lot of theological questions are being raised, is what's so fascinating right now in the 21st century is that science is now studying, taking into the laboratory, religious virtues. These virtues that religious people have carried forward across time, they're studying compassion, altruism, forgiveness. You know, there's one of the chapters of the book is my conversation about forgiveness and revenge and the biological basis for this. So they are actually potentially helping religious traditions better understand their own virtues and giving us pretty sophisticated knowledge about how they work, how forgiveness works, when it does, why, how to create the conditions for that. So potentially broadening and deepening some of religion's own core virtues. That's very interesting to me.
I know you have something to say about this, but here's what we're going to do. About eight people there. You each have 15 seconds to quickly ask a question.
I'm sorry about this, because my show is the anti-soundbite show.
Krista,
I wouldn't
Krista,
do this
no,
to you.
Simply
it's
because
Paul.
Krista is going to write down your questions and then answer them all in one go. If not, we'll be here for another hour. Go ahead.
Meine Frage kann nicht geantwortet werden mit anderen Fragen. Frau Tippett, ich höre Ihre Sendungen fast jede Woche an. Sie lebten mal in Deutschland und ich möchte gerne wissen, warum Sie dort gelebt haben, warum sind Sie zurückgekommen und wie hat Ihre Erlebnisse dort Ihr ganzes Leben beeinflusst?
Also I couldn't have said it better.
Yeah, vielen Dank. I lived in Berlin. Mostly in Berlin, yes.
Go ahead. In Portuguese, please. Go ahead.
I won't give it a try. I can do Hebrew if you like.
Okay.
I was curious how you thought Einstein's Jewishness and his escape from Europe affected his perspective.
Very much. And I do. It's in this show, and we also did another show called Einstein's Ethics, which is not in this book. His Jewish identity became more and more important to him as he grew older, and he was very involved with the State of Israel and believed that this wanted the State of Israel to survive, and actually was invited to be president. I don't know if people know that. What he said, what he loved about Judaism more and more was that it is not so, does not so much emphasize transcendence, but he said life as we live it and can know it. He was very drawn to that strong moral, ethical, the lived core of Judaism. That was a big piece of who he was.
Esperanto. I do have to say that the book is so balanced in many ways, and I think that's so important, so thank you. But to jump into the question, I think it's easier to reflect on interpersonal memories, whether with a spiritual leader or a rabbi, a priest, as moments in growth in one's own personal spiritual journey. But I guess my question is, how do you personally verify that, yes, these individual contemplative practices, that is, you know, nourishing the brain, and it's growing the brain, and it's making these connections?
Well, I can't verify it, but neuroscientists are verifying that. There's some really fascinating studies, especially with monastics, with Christian monastics and Buddhist monastics, what they call Olympic meditators. And these studies of meditation have actually helped neuroscience understand neuroplasticity, which is a huge revolution. It's only been in recent years that we understand the brain does change, and some of that has come from studying people and how the brain has changed through spiritual rituals and practices.
Right. I guess
we're going to move on. Oh. I'm so sorry. Forgive me, just because I want to get everybody in. Go ahead.
I'll try to be fast.
Please be.
People started believing in God or gods to try to explain what they couldn't understand, thunderstorms, etc. Now that we have all this scientific knowledge and we have so much more knowledge and access to information, the masses have great access to information, do you think that religion would evolve? And where do you think religions would evolve to?
Okay.
Where do you see it going?
Robert Wright, who wrote The Evolution of God, is on the show this coming weekend. And that's exactly what we talk about, so tune in.
Thank you. I was fortunate enough to spend a couple of months at Plum Village many years ago, and I was
Thich Nhat Hanh's community. Yes.
And I was also raised Catholic in a Catholic school for the first couple of years. One of the things that I've noticed both in the Buddhist monastics I was around and in the Catholic nuns is this deep sense of longing, it seems like that's the word that I've used to describe it, that they all seem to have. So my question is, do you think that people that have a deep sense of longing are more attracted to religion and spirituality, or that religion and spirituality kind of elicit a sense of longing, or kind of like they water the seeds of longing, maybe, perhaps?
I think you just raised the question, which is the only answer that I could give right now. It is a really intriguing question, and it is also something that scientists are looking at in a scientific way.
Really?
Yeah.
How would they look at that?
They can look at how some people who go towards spiritual professions have certain parts of the brain are more highly developed. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can see these biological distinctions.
And I should just emphasize from the science corner that neuroimaging is unbelievably advanced compared to where it was before, but unbelievably primitive, essentially. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day who said, our view of the brain is really like those pictures that were taken from the moon of the Earth. He said, they're very beautiful. You can see the weather systems and the continents. He said, to understand these questions, we need to be able to read the license plate. So I think there's a real feeling that we just sort of can't see that deep in yet. But getting there.
Andrew Solomon, Krista Tippett, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would have kept you longer.
I am glad that you have me given the opportunity of expressing to you here my deep sense of gratitude as a man, as a good European, and as a Jew. It cannot be my task today to act as a church of the conduct of a nation which for many years has considered me as her own. We are concerned not merely with the technical problem of securing and maintaining peace, but also with the important task of education and enlightenment. Without such freedom, there would have been no Shakespeare, no Goethe, no Newton, no Faraday, no Pasteur, and no Liszt.